welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's our weekly media roundtable when we bring together journalists to talk about the week's major stories and how they were covered. And this week, the big story is really a story about stories, taking the measure of the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. How does that frame of the first 100 days shape or misshape the way we think about and talk about the presidency and the way our politics work? What does it mean to talk about a successful or failed first 100 days? And while we can all name big stories from the past 99 days, Russian interference in the U.S. election, the attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, rising tensions with North Korea, and the Trump tax plan, have they overshadowed equally important developments that may not have caught the broad attention of reporters or the public? Joining us for this broad-ranging hour about coverage of Trump's first 100 days are three great reporters. Nancy Youssef is the first one of them. She's a national security correspondent with BuzzFeed News, and she is based in Washington. Nancy, so great to have you back on the program.
Great to be with you.
Also with us is David Dayan. He writes about finance and Wall Street, housing and other issues for Salon.com and The Intercept. He's also a weekly columnist for The New Republic and The Fiscal Times, and the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, which is out now in hardback, and I think will be out in paperback later this year. Is that right, David?
That's correct, in November. Thank you.
All right, good to have you with us. And finally, Will Bunch, also someone who's been on our air a number of times. Great to have you back, Will, veteran political journalist and columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of its popular blog, Attitude. So thank you so much, Will, for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we always start the program on Fridays by highlighting good journalism, because we do a lot of critique and we want to really champion people who are doing good work and give kudos to reporters and news outlets who've done something valuable this week. So let's go around the table and do that. Will, let's start with you. Will Bunch with the Philadelphia Daily News. What did you read or see this week that impressed you?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to use my hometown prerogative and cite a story that came here out of Philadelphia. It was written by a friend of mine, a great magazine journalist named Jason Figoni, who actually this piece ran in the Huffington Post. It was their lead story a couple days ago, so some of the listeners may have already seen this, but it's called What Bullets Do to Bodies, and it was really a deep dive into the whole gun violence crisis that's taking place here in Philadelphia, but also in other major cities around the country. And you know, he spent a lot of time with a surgeon who just, you know, has dealt with hundreds of these cases over the years, and just about some of her experiences, and just really the human toll of gun violence that kind of gets lost when we just kind of focus on the numbers. So it's a really good read. You know, Jason Figoni, What Bullets Do to Bodies, I highly recommend the piece.
That's on the Huffington Post, and we will post that at our website, yourcallradio.org. Thanks, Will. David Dayan, what did you see this week that impressed you in the media?
Well, mine was also from Huffington Post, which did a complete redesign this week. And sometimes the best journalism is just the simplest. So there, a long time ago, was a group called Fix the Debt. That was a group of individuals who were very concerned about the budget deficit and the national debt and entitlements raging out of control, things like this. And a number of corporate CEOs had signed on to this Fix the Debt initiative. Hmm. And so what the Huffington Post did was go back to all of those corporate CEOs and asked them what they thought about the corporate tax cut announced this week as a plan by Donald Trump, which would put multi-trillion dollar holes in the budget deficit. And none of them said that they had a problem with a corporate tax cut. These CEOs obviously have a vested interest in lowering their tax burden. So the deficit concerns went completely out the window when their interests were involved. So it was just a simple piece of journalism, but sometimes that's the best stuff.
Well, it's a good example of accountability reporting for corporate leaders, right? We often have with people who are in government saying, okay, Donald Trump, you said X. Well, in fact, you're doing Y, or now you're saying something completely different, but that's not as common when it comes to corporate leaders.
Absolutely. So bravo to Huffington Post and their new regime, their new redesign.
Nancy Youssef, national security correspondent with BuzzFeed. What piece or item did you see this week that you thought was an example of good reporting?
Well, I guess my favorite story was about a baseball player named Gift Ngobi. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, and he's the first African-born professional baseball player. He had his first hit this week against the Chicago Cubs, and it was an interesting story because the way he kind of got introduced to baseball was his mother was a groundskeeper at a baseball field in South Africa, and he was in the AAA League for 8.5 years before appearing before the Pittsburgh Pirates this week. Stepped up, had a hit, and had a walk, and it was just lovely because he said, I didn't want to cry when I stepped up because I'm a big guy, and it was just a really neat thing to see. Everyone loves baseball, and everyone loves someone who works so hard to make a dream come true, so I really loved it.
Nancy, thanks so much for bringing a bit of baseball into the Media Roundtable. Doesn't happen too often here on Your Call, so and as a fan myself, I do appreciate it. We will post links to all those stories at our website, yourcallradio.org, and we do also invite you to submit your examples of great reporting from the week. You can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, and post there. You can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. We are always looking for your input. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Your Call Media Roundtable. The big story this week, as I said when I opened, is really this kind of story about what were the big stories or what have been the big developments of the last 3 months of the Trump administration, the first 3 months. And I guess I just want to quickly go around to the three of you and kind of ask, when it comes to, obviously I'm sure you've all read lots of this reporting and have done some of it yourself. And when you think about this kind of attempt to take this artificial mark of 100 days and to talk, especially when there's so much talk about a success or failure through this period, what you think that does to the reporting in a good way or a bad way? And maybe we start with you, Will.
I think the reporting on the whole has been good. I think a couple things that have concerned me, and I wrote about these in my analysis of the first 100 days that I just posted, which is called "It May Take Years to Undo What Trump Did in His First 100 Days." But a couple things. One is, while there's been coverage of the corruption involving Trump and the Trump family, just the, refusal to break ties with the Trump organization, with its myriad conflicts of interest all over the world, the constant use and the endorsement of the Trump properties with Mar-a-Lago and his different golf courses, negotiating with countries like China over trademarks at the same time they're, negotiating the One China policy. I mean, I think these stories have been reported, but I just think I still don't think the public has really gotten a full sense of just the scale of the massive corruption that we're seeing out of the White House that we've never seen any other president. The other thing that I would add quickly is I think the one area that really where that really hasn't gotten nearly enough attention is the kind of foreign policy and the way that we're continuing to wage war in places like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan with almost no scrutiny from the media. It's interesting that Trump's one-night attack on Syria and the 59 cruise missiles, just got an enormous amount of attention. But meanwhile, we've been conducting these military campaigns in Iraq and Syria, where there have been literally hundreds of civilians have been killed with almost no media coverage. I think the generals are clearly running the show at the Pentagon and at the National Security Council, and there's just hardly any scrutiny of what America's military policy in the Middle East and Central Asia actually is. I think that's unfortunate.
So, Nancy, this is exactly your area, what you cover. You've been doing that reporting. How would you respond to what Will has to say and how you think of it in this 100 days coverage?
Well, I mean, the thing is, first, you know, the 100-day sort of construct was born in the New Deal when Roosevelt was coming in, and this idea of 100 days to get all these ideas implemented, and ever since it's been a part of the political discourse. I think on national security, it's actually been an area where it's gotten more attention because it's arguably one of the biggest successes the Trump administration has had, given the strike in Syria and the ability, to, at least in the short term, to stop North Korea from conducting any nuclear ICBM tests. I think my colleague on the call is right when he says that it doesn't sort of lend itself foreign policy to 100 days in terms of evaluation because these things take over a period of months and years. Most foreign policy changes don't happen so quickly and frankly haven't happened under the Trump administration. Even under the Syria strike, it was a strike but didn't lead to a policy change. The movement of the aircraft carrier and the submarine toward the Sea of Japan is a show of force, and we've seen a North Korea that so far has not done any worrisome tests. But in terms of foreign policy, it's very young. So on one hand, it's fair to say that that foreign policy stories haven't really been aggressive about the 100 days, but I think it's such a political construct that just doesn't fit for national security reporting, generally speaking.
What about Will Bunch's observation about the generals kind of being in charge in a way that perhaps they weren't in the Obama administration? Do you see that contrast?
Well, that's a great observation, and I think a very important takeaway from this period, because the use of the MOAB, or what's affectionately known as the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, the 21,000-pound conventional bomb, the White House didn't sign off on or even wasn't even notified about that. The Syrian strike was something that was sort of constructed by the Pentagon, and I'm calling you from the Pentagon, where you see generals who say that they have a level of autonomy that they didn't have under the previous administration. Now, the reality is the military will look at things from their prism. It's understandable. And so arguably by giving them so much power, you're not bringing in other agencies as much as maybe they need to be, like Treasury or the State Department. And by giving them so much power and so much autonomy, there's the risk that every problem becomes a nail when that hammer has so much authority to act out its ideas and policies relatively unilaterally.
And Dave Dayan, I wanted to turn to you. I mean, in your area of where you have covered and reported deeply when it comes to financial regulation and how what happens in Washington and New York in terms of finances affect what happens to people on the ground around the country. What do you think, what kind of coverage do you think that's gotten in the first 100 days? And are there developments that people should know about who don't follow this as closely as you do?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the general narrative on domestic policy overall is that Trump has not been able to get a lot done legislatively. The Obamacare failure, the tax reform one sheeter in the first 100 days, those kinds of things. But what has actually been accomplished are a series of deregulatory actions through something known as the Congressional Review Act. 13 separate regulations were essentially nullified through this resolution of disapproval, and the reason that it was done is that you could get around the filibuster in the Senate, and it required only a majority vote. And Trump has signed 13 of these actions, and they vary in significance, but it's not a little thing to have done this. And these are only, when you're talking about deregulation, these are only the legislative accomplishments there. There have also been a number of various regulatory actions that have been delayed or put up for different review, whether you're talking about net neutrality, the FCC's regulation, the sort of assault on rescinding that has started this week. What you call the fiduciary rule, which would force investment advisors to act in the best interest of their clients, that has been delayed repeatedly. And I could go down the line. I'd probably spend the next hour talking about all of the different regulations that have been delayed, rescinded, or somehow put aside. And even then, you don't encompass the fact that who you put in the positions to actually enforce regulations matters. You can sort of repeal these things through neglect. And so what you have, the picture that is painted, is that there has been, you know, significant accomplishment on the general idea that corporations should be able, or you know, anyone subject to a regulation should be able to move freely without much scrutiny of their activities. So I think, you know, that sort of is a counter to this narrative that a whole lot hasn't been done through the first 100 days. At least on the deregulation aspect, there's plenty that has been done, both with the support of Congress and, you know, through executive actions.
That's David Diane, investigative reporter, also with us on today's Your Call Media Roundtable. Nancy Youssef, national security correspondent with BuzzFeed, and Will Bunch with the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and invite you to join this conversation to talk about reporting you saw this week that was good, that was bad, that you thought missed the point. Also, very interested in your thoughts about coverage of the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Who helped you get it right, feel like you got beyond the kind of surface coverage to really talk about what's happening and what the 100 days set the stage for? The number to call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Will, I wanted to follow up on some of what David was talking about. I was thinking about one example when he's talking about these kind of changes in regulations that have happened in ways that maybe just they aren't front page news. And I think about the passage of the rollback of internet privacy regulations in the same week that the big push for repealing Obamacare happened. And of course, everyone's attention was focused on that vote and whether or not it would take place and what would happen. And meanwhile, these other votes were taking place. They're the kind of thing that you would think this is a pretty big deal. And so I'm wondering what you're thinking about some of the big stories about where Donald Trump has not gotten what he wanted, or the Republican majority has not been able to work with him, while meanwhile there's some background stories that are being missed.
Yeah, I think he's been able to affect change more dramatically and to my mind in a negative, destructive way. Then I think people are giving him credit, if that's the right term for. And I mean, I would focus on. I mean, I think the internet privacy is one good area to focus on. But I think the area where he's had the most impact, arguably, is the environment. And you know, it's such an important issue because of the way the climate change could affect all of us, and not just in the United States but around the world. You know, a lot of people think. This issue should really be the number one priority for governments now, and Trump's been able to use executive fiat to make dramatic changes on environmental policy. Outside of the Gorsuch nomination, you could argue his biggest quote achievement unquote has been getting both the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access pipeline approved, and you know, there's oil already flowing in the Dakota Access pipeline, which was the site of so many protests last fall and last winter. We have a complete reversal in our energy policy that is now, again, biased towards fossil fuels, that is, you know, promoting the use of coal, which is the dirtiest fossil fuel of all. I mean, one of the first actions of the administration was to make it easier for coal concerns to, you know, pollute nearby streams. So, this has been a really dramatic policy change, and I think it goes to show that a president can really, just oversee such a vast bureaucracy that he can really accomplish quite a few things, even if there's total gridlock in Congress, which, for the most part, except for, as Dave was saying, except for these overturning Obama regulations that they can do with 51 votes. He's been pretty stymied in his legislation, and I think that may continue. I mean, I don't think they'll ever get anywhere on Obamacare, for example. But at the same time, the power to kind of erode and the administrative state just by administrative fiat is very strong.
Well, I mean, the big story in terms of thinking about potential legislation this week, obviously, was this one-sheeter tax plan that that the administration put out. And I'm interested, David, in your perspective, looking at. So, I mean, we now have a pretty good sense of what the split is in the Republican Party that may make rolling back Obamacare impossible. But this week, a lot of people were talking about, okay, well, you know, where are the budget hawks going to come down on the tax plan? And I'd be just curious how you think. You know, when you look at the politics of that, what you think the likelihood is?
I think that in general, at the end of the day, there's less of a split within the Republican Party on the merits of lowering taxes than there apparently is on the merits of repealing Obamacare. On Obamacare, you really have kind of a policy split. There are those within the Republican Party that really don't appear to want to actually repeal the law. They want to throw pot shots at it, and they want to play politics with it. But they you know, when it comes down to it, there's resistance on the so-called moderate Republican side of actually, you know, eliminating the pre-existing condition exclusion or things of that nature that are fairly popular. On taxes, I don't think you have that kind of policy split within the Republican Party. There are some who might want, in a perfect world, to not have this blow a big hole in the deficit, but I think that's a far lesser concern than getting the tax cuts done, rewarding sort of their constituency, which is, you know, wealthy individuals and corporations, and letting it take care of itself. You know, we've heard a lot about, you know, tax cuts will pay for themselves through the expansion of economic activity that they will generate. That's highly debatable, but it's sort of their outs on this. Now, there are budget rules that say, you know, if you want to use this process that circumvents the filibuster and keeps Democrats out of the decision making, it can't raise the deficit over a 10-year window. We saw this in the Bush administration in their 2001 and 2003 tax cuts. They used this process known as budget reconciliation, and they let the tax cut sunset in 2011. Because they could not raise the budget deficit over the 10-year window. And I think ultimately that is what Republicans will end up doing, is they kind of don't want to. They put forward this thing called a border adjustment tax, which would have raised money in terms of taxing imports, essentially. It's a long story, but that's the short of it. And that was jettisoned by Trump after a lot of ferocious pushback, particularly from retailers who get a lot of their imports overseas. So I think you'll see they'll just use the sunset provision and let these expire in 10 years and hope to expand them down the road. But, you know, ultimately it just feels like there's not enough difference within the Republican caucus and that some form of tax cuts will get done.
That's David Diane. He's a contributor to several publications, including The Nation, The Intercept, and The American Prospect. He's also author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Also joining us on today's Your Call Media Roundtable are Nancy Youssef, national security correspondent with BuzzFeed, and Will Bunch, political columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News and the writer of the blog Attitude. That's ATTYTOOD, if you want to check that out online. You can find links to all of our guests' stories at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back with more of the Media Roundtable after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. toll-free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. And KALW's May campaign starts on Tuesday, our first on-air fundraiser in 8 months. Help us keep the programming uninterrupted and the pledge breaks short. Make your early gift today at KALW.org. Thanks.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Monday's program, we are going to be talking to Jonathan Rosenblum. He is a veteran labor organizer who's out with a new book called Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. On May Day, we're going to be talking about what will be required to build a powerful, inclusive labor movement. Obviously, labor has been on the wane for many decades, and that's had a powerful impact on our economy. We'll talk with Jonathan Rosenblum about how he thinks that trajectory can be changed. And we welcome your calls and emails on today's Your Call Media Roundtable. We're talking with Will Bunch from the Philadelphia Daily News, Nancy Youssef, National Security Correspondent with BuzzFeed, and financial journalist David Diane. The number to call if you would like to join the conversation, bring what you think is good journalism from the week to the roundtable, or to talk about things you think the media got wrong this week, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nancy, I wanted to come back to you because you cover foreign affairs. You're a national security correspondent. And I think that, you know, a lot of this, when it comes to the domestic side, there's been a lot of sorting out about, you know, what can the congressional Republican majority agree with Donald Trump about? Where can they go along with what he's doing and where can they not? And, you know, how they make that work and basically leave the Democrats out of the picture altogether. But I'm interested thinking about Congress's role in foreign policy to the extent that it still has one, since, you know, we don't really approve wars by Congress anymore, that kind of thing. Just what you see as the relationship between this new president, this administration, obviously new Secretary of State and Defense, and Congress around the issues that you cover.
Well, I have to tell you, the most interesting period was in the first 100 days was the serious strike, because it's not clear to me the legal justification for hitting Syria. So far, since 2001, under the authorization for the use of military force, the president has used that bill to say he could strike at Al-Qaeda and later ISIS. Well, neither Al-Qaeda nor ISIS was the target of the Syria strike. This was another government's forces. And it would have been an opportunity for the Congress to sort of step in and sort of exert its constitutional authorities in terms of the use of military force. And that didn't happen. And instead, we heard from Democrats asking about the legality of it, and Republicans who'd criticized the President Obama for his use of force in Iraq and Syria and Yemen a little bit quieter. So to me, the interesting dynamic is how that is resolved going forward as the kinds of threats get more complex and the military options are so far seem to be exerted by the Pentagon, absent a White House, and now, at least so far, a Congress.
And what about the Secretary of State?
Well, so Tillerson gave two very interesting interviews to Fox News and to NPR, and he mentioned, he hasn't been able to fill a lot of senior positions in his department, but he didn't speak up really about this sort of more aggressive Defense Department, and has so far, while on paper supposed to be the lead on things like North Korea, has, from this building's perspective, it doesn't appear to really take an assertive stance. And so he called for example, direct negotiations with North Korea, something that historically hasn't been done before. He has talked about the use of military options. What you're seeing is a Defense Department that's also been stepping up as sort of quasi-diplomats. It was very interesting. Admiral Harris, who's the Pacific Command commander, whose area includes North Korea, was asked by a congressman this week, what diplomatic role are you playing, which I thought was interesting because the admiral said, that's not my job to be a diplomat. And the congressman said, well, the State Department is so short right now, I'm assuming you're having to step up. And so it was an interesting exchange in terms of the expectations on the military to fill in those kinds of voids.
Well, I thought it was interesting what you mentioned earlier when you were looking at 100 days coverage and the way that actually foreign policy has gotten played a little more than it might have been expected to, simply because that's someplace where the president's been able to move and claim successes, whether or not, of course, you think long-term that they actually will be a successful, whatever that means, in the national interest.
Sure.
So I'm just interested in the way you think about the way, so far, we're seeing the Trump administration use foreign policy as something, you know, as something popular, as something that they use to rally support.
Well, I think that most the interesting example was the decision by the Egyptian government to release a woman by the name of Aya Hagazi, who was a dual Egyptian-American national, an NGO worker who had been detained for 3 years. And the president said that this came about because of essentially his direct involvement with the Sisi government. And what was interesting to me is, though, on the face of that, that looks like a great thing. This was something that the Obama administration wasn't able to do. Now, the flip of it is, long-term, when you have the president engaging directly on these kinds of issues, there are, and not using sort of the State Department, not using sort of direct channels, and someone like Sisi, who doesn't necessarily share the kinds of traditional American values, that there are risks long-term by engaging, because now you sort of have a situation where the president might owe something to that leader. It just gets a little too personal, if that makes sense. And so on the face of it, it was a great story to see her released. But at the same time, it raised questions longer-term about the consequences of using sort of unconventional means to secure these kinds of releases.
David or Will, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, clearly the Trump administration is just a very kind of top-oriented outfit where, you know, all the decisions and any kind of operations seem to be done, you know, from the White House or a very small level, because most of these key department jobs, as Nancy was alluding to, I think, before, just haven't been filled. If you look at the numbers, they're stunning. I think there's over 500 or over 550 presidential appointments when you look at all the deputy secretaries and whatnot, and more than 400 of these appointments haven't even been made yet, including, as she alluded to, none of the key posts in the State Department. It's interesting because I think this is how Donald Trump ran the Trump Organization for all these years, too. I mean, this is kind of his management style, is to have a small, tight inner circle, but you're talking about a massive enterprise with the federal government, and there's really questions about whether you can run the federal government in that style.
Yeah, and does that eventually become a problem to implement policy? And David, it sounds like you wanted to get in here.
Yeah, certainly, and it's as Will alluded to, it's not just that sort of Democratic obstructionism is causing this lack of personnel, that most of them haven't been nominated at all. And when pressed on this, the president said in an interview that he didn't want to put those names forward because he didn't think they were important. So yes, you have a ton of centralizing of power. In fact, there's a theory out there that one of the reasons why the policy drift has tended toward Gary Cohn, who's the National Economic Council director and former Goldman Sachs president, is because he has actually hired people. They don't require any Senate oversight or confirmation process, and he's actually hired policy people. And because he has the policy professionals and nobody else does, the drift has gone in his direction because they're actually making plans, and a plan beats no plan. So at least on domestic policy, there's a tremendous centralization of power, even though the ultimate power of the presidency is fairly limited. I mean, you talk about these executive orders that have come out on almost a daily basis out of this White House. Most of them really don't direct anything at all except for the writing of reviews at the various federal agencies. It remains to be seen whether those reviews will be written. But this is something where the media is maybe reporting this in a little bit of a charitable way. It's not that the president signs an executive order to dismantle Dodd-Frank or to open the Keystone XL pipeline. He signs an executive order that says, you know, let's review the dismantling of Dodd-Frank or various regulations or scrutinize them, or let's get the permitting done within a certain number of days on Keystone XL after TransCanada resubmits its application. There's this combination of policymaking among a very small select group and then the realization that you can't do that. And so this outsourcing of these reports and reviews, and it remains to be seen what will come of that, it kind of makes for this very ad hoc dynamic in the White House.
Well, and another thing about, you know, his way of running, you know, that kind of connection between the way he ran the Trump organization and the way he's now running the Trump administration is obviously the really great importance of longtime friends of the president and his family. And I'd like to hear all of you kind of weigh in about how do we, you know, looking at the, I mean, it's an unusual presidency in a whole lot of ways, but that's one that's got to be right up there. Maybe starting with you, Nancy, in the foreign affairs realm, how you kind of see those kind of friends and family of Donald Trump shaping anything to the extent that you do.
Well, I mean, I think one of the most influential people has been Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. We saw that when he traveled to Iraq at the invitation of the military, which recognized that to get to the president, you had to go by way of Jared Kushner, which is something we hadn't seen before. This is a 36-year-old man who hasn't really worked in Washington or served in the military or sort of been exposed to government work. Suddenly, the key piece to crafting national security policy. I mean, if you look at the portfolio of things that he's in charge of, it's everything from opioid addiction to solving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And so the fact that it's so centralized and that somebody with such little traditional experience holds the key, and the fact that you have even a military that felt the need to take him into a combat zone to sort of help him understand what they do is something we haven't seen in Washington before.
Yeah. Absolutely, and not only is Kushner this sort of jack of all trades, but he's married to the president's daughter who, in addition to being a White House aide, has an existing business that continues to work all around the world, and has recently received trademarks in China. So you have Jared Kushner on the one hand setting all of this policy, and then the Chinese granting these very lucrative trademarks to his wife in a way that just sort of seems like the way that officials pass favors along to induce better policy outcomes. This is not an untold story, but it's a really tremendous story in terms of what the goals of Trump and his family and top officials really are. Are they, you know, making good policy for the United States or personal self-aggrandizement?
Yeah, and it sounds like the kind of things you hear about in, the writer Sarah Kendzior, who has her roots in Uzbekistan. She says, you know, this is the kind of thing that she sees in the country where her family is from, Uzbekistan, you know, or these other faraway republics that we always say, you know, thank God we live in the United States, and we don't have a kind of a government where the president's son-in-law is getting graft and getting all these contracts, and all of a sudden it's happening, you know. And I mean, also I think it speaks to just kind of a general kind of paranoia and lack of trust within the Trump inner circle that, you know, that the president feels the only person he can trust is his son-in-law. And so you get this ridiculous situation where he has this portfolio where he's going to bring peace to the Middle East and reform government at the same time. I think Dave's right, and I think it's just one of the biggest stories of this administration, and it just can't get enough attention.
And this week there's a piece out from Jesse Drucker in the New York Times about Jared Kushner's work with a some real estate folks in Israel that are under investigations. I mean, that those kind of I mean, I think there's so many stories around these questions of conflict of interest that that maybe each one of them at a time doesn't have an impact. And I also wonder, you know, how it then connects back to. So there's like a sense of like, oh, is there some kind of a presidency that's operating on the interests of a relatively narrow group of people? And then meanwhile, you have congressional Republicans. You have a party that has had some long-term goals about what it wants to do in Washington. Now it's got majorities, got control of all three branches of government, and you know what that interaction is between those two realities. Anybody jump in? Or nobody. I mean, it's a good time to say you're listening to the Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, and I am sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Media Roundtable. Our guests are Nancy Youssef, national security correspondent with BuzzFeed, David Diane, financial journalist who contributes to several publications, including The Intercept and The Nation, and Will Bunch, who's a longtime political journalist with the Philadelphia Daily News. And we invite you to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Nancy Youssef, wanted to come back to you talking about Jared Kushner. Obviously, part of his portfolio, such as it is, to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, which of course has been on the portfolio of many people in the United States government for a long time. What do you see the impact on the part of the world that you have covered for so long, being with, you know, someone like Jared Kushner and the other folks who are very close to Donald Trump? What do you think what do you see as the impacts of that?
Well, I think what we've seen in terms of the dealing with Mexico and Canada, and just as recently as today with South Korea, is an approach of, some would argue, bargaining, if you will. That is, he starts from sort of extreme positions of Mexico is going to pay for the wall, or say with South Korea, they're going to have to pay for their missile. U.S. provided missile defense system, and this sort of approach of, and you're starting to see other countries now respond in kind, and then move to the middle. So, presumably on those kinds of issues, we may see that same approach where both. So when we hear it sort of sounds shocking, and in fact shocks world leaders to either call or move on their positions. And I think we'll see more of the same in the weeks and months ahead.
And do you think, when it comes to the Middle East, do you think, what noises are there about what kind of policy there might be out of the Trump administration?
Well, I think the one people are looking for the most is on Syria, because it's an area where the U.S. conducted strikes, and on the broader war against ISIS, and in particular, what happens to Iraq and parts of Syria when the U.S. military campaign against ISIS ends, if it in fact is able to end in the next months or maybe a couple years ahead, as the U.S. military is anticipated. What kind of rebuild happens, and how is the U.S. in conjunction with its allies in the region able to stop an ISIS or some subsidiary or regrowth out of it from emerging again?
You know, talking about the coverage of the first 100 days of the Trump administration, I think there's always implicitly some comparison to the last administration when you do this. And this week, obviously, we, interestingly enough, had a bit of public reemergence from Barack Obama. And I was interested in David Diane, you've written about this, and Will Bunch, I'll also be interested in what you have to say. We had this week Barack Obama coming back out into public, and part of that being him getting paid a lot of money to speak to some Wall Street folks. David Diane, talk about that.
Well, the news was that he will receive a $400,000 speaker's fee, which apparently is the going rate, because he's already received it for a talk he's already given to A&E Networks. But this $400,000 fee in September will be for a healthcare conference that's put on by the financial institution Cantor Fitzgerald. And obviously the association with Wall Street and taking Wall Street money harkens back to the presidential campaign with regards to Hillary Clinton and her speeches to Goldman Sachs and other various financial institutions. And so there's been sort of a raging debate on the left over whether this kind of buck raking, as it were, creates an appearance of impropriety or bad optics, or should a former president be doing this? Is this sort of an emoluments on a time delay system? If you're getting these speaker fees after the fact, are you thinking about that when you're setting policy in your time in the White House? My feeling, and I have written actually about this very issue at Vice Magazine, is that the president sort of made his choice to align with the financial industry back when he put very few strings on the bailout, did not come up with a credible plan to help homeowners, allowed 9.3 million of them to lose their homes, and at a point of a massive legal exposure for the financial industry and its executives, did nothing through his Justice Department to actually make sure anybody was prosecuted. I mean, the die has been cast. It's not money from a speaker's fee that is going to show that Obama aligns himself with Wall Street. That alignment, in my view, has already been set out through policy 8 years going. So I cared a little bit less about the money he's getting after the fact than the what was happening in real time with respect to the financial industry and homeowners and foreclosures. So that was kind of my take on it.
Will Bunch?
I actually also wrote a short piece about Obama and the $4,000 fee at my blog Attitude this week, and I was critical of it. Not so much as a direct criticism of Obama, although certainly, it does merit a reexamination of his policies towards Wall Street. But, I'm just kind of repulsed by the whole practice that, our ex-presidents get these kind of tributes, and a tribute is really a cousin to bribery, right? You know, of getting these just enormous fees for giving in a lot of cases is a canned speech, or a 40-minute speech that's worth $400,000. I mean, I was appalled at the practice when Ronald Reagan got $2 million to speak to the Japanese after he left the presidency. I was very critical of Hillary Clinton's practices, which had an added dimension because she was looking to get back into the government and regulate these companies, right? I mean, what I wrote is, we already have executive orders and some laws regulating whether officials can lobby after they leave office. I'd like to see that type of regulation extended to speeches where maybe fees are capped for, a legitimate speaking fee of $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000, as opposed to being able to pay somebody $225,000, $400,000, or $2 million to give a speech to a group that they just spent 8 years regulating. I think it looks very unseemly.
And I don't know, Nancy Youssef, do you have any thoughts on kind of Barack Obama at this moment coming back out into public?
No, I mean, I think it's an interesting contrast, and it's a reminder sort of how much for me things have changed in terms of foreign policy, in terms of how we talk about foreign policy and how it's received. And you can see how, when you hear him speak, there's sort of changes in tones and why it's sort of led to different reactions in the world, and sort of you can understand in a way the challenges they have in terms of assessing the U.S. standing, because it's been such a sharp change in such a short period of time.
Yeah, and for you, obviously closely watching how these men speak, just outline a couple of those, the key contrasts to you.
Well, I mean, the Obama administration was always reticent to get involved. There was a lot of caveats in the speeches he gave, and the way that he talked about foreign policy. I mean, the words, in a way, sort of reflect the action, where the Obama administration was very, very measured and conservative. Some would say too much so. The militarily, you see a sort of impulse hitting back style in the Trump administration that almost matches the punchiness of his rhetoric. Now, in terms of substantive policy changes, I don't think we've seen it yet. We've seen a lot of talk in that direction, but a lot of these things are a lot more complicated than they seem on the surface in terms of making changes. I think we saw that this week with NAFTA. But the rhetoric and then the subsequent or lack of military action, in this case, the words in some ways mirror the actions.
And then this May, it looks like Barack Obama is going to be going to Germany to talk with Angela Merkel. So he'll be around on the world scene. Do you have any sense of what you think, like, in terms of knowing what he was like as a president, what he might be trying to do in that role?
Well, he's talked about doing things like addressing gerrymandering. He, in his first public experience, was really urging youth to join the political process. My guess is he'll be addressing things like wage gaps, like the polarization that we're seeing across the world, and try to use the pulpit that is an ex-president as a way to tackle some of these issues, because they bleed into so many others, and of course environmental issues, which increasingly are as much a national security threat as they are anything else.
Thank you, Nancy. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We got about 2 minutes left, and I would love to hear from all three of you about what you're working on now, what's coming down the pike that that our listeners can pay attention to, that that you'll be working on. Will Bunch, let's start with you.
Well, All Politics is local. I'm doing a lot right now on we're picking a new district attorney in my hometown of Philadelphia, and it has national implications because, you know, Philadelphia is a city that's had a harsh criminal justice system, lots of use of the death penalty, mass incarceration, and we have a raft of candidates that are talking about changing that and changing the justice system that you know, is more responsive to the public and less punitive, and the election's in 3 weeks, and I'm giving a lot of attention locally to that issue, and I think other cities are grappling with the same issue as well.
Seems like that could have national implications. David, Diane, what are you working on?
As you mentioned, there's a paperback edition of my book Chain of Title coming out in November, so there will be a foreword in that edition, so there'll be some new material in there. One thing I'm looking at is with respect to these executive orders, and I kind of alluded to it before, I don't think people have a sense of just how many reports have been recommended and requested by the president, and with firm deadlines. I mean, we're talking almost 100 of them. And I don't feel like anybody is tracking whether those reports are actually getting done, and you know, what will go forward from them. So that might be an area of my reporting going forward.
Thank you, David. And Nancy, what's on your docket?
Well, I mean, as you know, the U.S. Lost two troops in Afghanistan this week at a time when there was a review happening about potentially sending additional forces in. So given that the war is entering its 16th year and is so often forgotten, I'd just like to look at what it means going ahead when you ask for additional troops. Will it happen? To what end? And what is the future of the war in Afghanistan? What is an acceptable outcome for the United States?
Well, I'm going to thank you all for being with us for a really informative hour. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. Our guests this hour have been Nancy Youssef, national security correspondent with BuzzFeed, Will Bunch with the Philadelphia Daily News, and David Diane, who contributes to several publications, including The Nation and The Intercept, and who has his book, Chain of Title, which is going to be out in paperback in November. Thanks to everyone who got in touch during this hour. Your Call is produced at the studios of KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. You can always email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.